Okay? Okay? Okay. It's a fantastic crowd, and I think we'll certainly get going. I'm Christine Chinkin. I'm Director of the Centre of Women, Peace and Security here at the London School of Economics, and delighted to welcome so many of you here to what's the first public event of the Centre for the new academic year. So special welcomes to new students, and particularly new students on the MSc Women, Peace and Security course, and also, I see a number of you in the front row, those who have been working all day on Women, Peace and Security in an intensive course that we're running on the subject. So welcome to the event, which is United Nations Peace Operations, Politics, Human Rights and Leadership. I wonder if the great attention is from the publicity being given to the UN this week by speeches by certain leaders that seem to have hit the news events. Okay, I'll just quickly explain the format, and then I will introduce the speakers, and then I'll hand over to our incredible group of speakers. Essentially, it's a conversation. It's a conversation between our three main speakers, which will be moderated by Bella, who is sitting on the right. So they're going to have a conversation, essentially, around their experiences both in and outside the United Nations, prompted by the questions that the moderator will be asking each of them. After they finish their conversation, they'll join in conversation with you, so questions that come from the audience. The event will finish at 8 o'clock, no later than 8 o'clock. There is no reception tonight after this event, but I've been asked to also tell you about our next two public events that are coming up, when there will be receptions afterwards. 28th of September, there is an evening discussion on, late afternoon actually, but all details are on the website, on women, peace and security in Chile. And on the Tuesday, the 7th of November, we come back to the United Nations and we have an event on United Nations and gender. How can the United Nations lead on this topic? So the LSE Women, Peace and Security website has all details of these and other activities that we're carrying out. So the speakers. And coming alphabetically, but in fact for closest on this side, is Diane Corner. Diane was Deputy Special Representative and Deputy Head of the United Nations Multidimensional Integrated Stabilization Mission in the Central African Republic from Minusca, yes, rather easily, from 2014 to 2017, with responsibility for political affairs, human rights, DDR, mine clearance, protection of civilians, and women and children protection. Before that, Diane Corner worked for the Foreign and Commonwealth Office for 32 years with diplomatic postings in numerous different places. And then next to her is Bintu Keita. Now, this is what's really exciting, as earlier this week, the United Nations Secretariat General announced the appointment of Bintu as Assistant Secretary General for Peacekeeping Operations. And she's the first woman to take on this role as well, which makes it even greater. Ms. Keita has joined the United Nations since 1989, Deputy Joint Special Representative for the African Union United Nations Hybrid Operation in Darfur, that's UNAMID, and also had position as the Ebola Crisis Manager for Sierra Leone from 2014 to 2015. And then on the far left is Karen Landgren, who's another first, the first woman to head three United Nations peace operations. So until 2015, she was a UN Undersecretary General and head of the peacekeeping operation in Liberia, again also leading the response to Ebola at the height of the epidemic. Other political missions in Burundi and in Nepal, worked on refugee protection, statelessness, and in 2005 developed a widely used approach to child protection, the Protective Environment Framework. So I think that is a fantastic panel of just remarkable women. So the conversation is going to be very, very interesting. And the moderator and facilitator is Bella Kapoor, who is the visiting senior fellow in the Center for Women, Peace and Security, an expert on women, peace and security in policy and practice. Again, she has worked on conflict issues at the multilateral level for more than two decades, again within the United Nations, the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, Department of Peacekeeping Operations and Political Affairs, has worked on numerous reports of the United Nations, including on East Timor, on situations of women in Afghanistan, and the 2015 report of the High-Level Panel on Peace Operations. So that is the remarkable lineup that we have this evening. I do have just two final announcements. One is somebody's picked up a hotel, looks like a hotel key, that appears to have been dropped on somewhere. I'll leave it here on the lectern, so if it's somebody's, they could just come and pick it up at the end of the event. And the other issue is silence your phones, please, the usual. And anybody wishing to comment on the evening's events, the hashtag is on the board over there. So with that, thank you, Bella, and I hand over to you.
Thank you so much, Christine, and thank you very much to the Centre for Women, Peace and Security for organising this event. As you can tell, given the challenges facing international peace and security today, particularly what we're hearing coming from the General Assembly meetings in New York, and given the amazing experience of the three panelists today, there is so much that we could be talking about. We could be here till 8 a.m. tomorrow morning. So what we've actually done is identify a couple of key questions that we thought would be useful to start this conversation with the panelists, which we think are really timely, interesting, and hopefully will stimulate further discussion with yourselves when we get to the broader public discussion. So what I want to do is just dive straight in and ask you, please, Karen, first of all, to begin the response on the discussion on challenges to peace and security today. And given where we stand today, the specific threats facing international peace and security today, what do you think are the biggest challenges the UN faces to contribute to peace and security? And within that, how do those challenges specifically impact women? Thank you.
Thank you, Bella. You've convened us at a pretty bleak moment in international affairs, but let me just begin by thanking you for convening us at all. It's a pleasure to be back at LSE, and I want to thank Dr. Chinkin, the Center for Women, Peace and Security, and you. And it's a delight to be on a panel with these amazing, admirable women leaders in peace and security. And if there is one thing I'd like you to take away from this evening before I descend into the challenges, it is to please, if you haven't already done so, consider a career in international peace operations, because there is no more exciting place to be, even if right now it's a little more interesting than we would like it to be. So the NATO Secretary General, Jens Stoltenberg, has said that the world is at its most dangerous point in a generation, 30 years, he said. And the Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, said, speaking to the General Assembly the other day, the world is in trouble. And these are not people who say these things lightly. This tremendous volatility right now ought to make the UN more relevant, more necessary than ever. But the biggest challenge for the UN is to try to overcome this enormous fragmentation and polarization that we see in the world right now. And that challenge for the UN is at three levels. And the first one is obviously globally. I was just this morning watching the Secretary General's remarkable speech, which I recommend you listen to if you haven't. And he said, our sense of global community may be disintegrating. When these dangers involve permanent members of the Security Council, it limits the UN effectiveness. Having a divided Security Council not backing decisive action by the UN simply means that the UN is able to do less, just when it needs to be doing the most. The purpose of the UN itself is collective action. The members of the Security Council are expected to lead in that unity and decisiveness, not be out there banging the drums of war. The Secretary General said fiery talk can lead to fatal misunderstandings, but quite honestly, I cannot believe that we are talking about nuclear war as something that might actually happen. For the IR students here, you know that Woodrow Wilson's 14 points began with a pledge to have open covenants openly arrived at, but as some people say, sometimes the UN becomes open threats openly arrived at. But I have never before heard threats like this on the floor of the General Assembly. The most used word in President Trump's speech was sovereignty, and of course that is legitimate, but it does tend to strengthen the hand of those who want to keep the UN out of domestic affairs at a time when we really need multilateralism. So restoring that sense of shared purpose is the number one global challenge. But we're also seeing this intense fragmentation at national level. And of course, we can point to faraway places, South Sudan, DRC, Myanmar, but we see weakening social cohesion as a worldwide phenomenon. And there are so many triggers, from economic inequality to jobs, but right now the critical battleground for this is around national identity and the very idea of having inclusive societies. So we see countries reopening seemingly settled questions of who belongs and who doesn't, failing to reconcile with their own past histories of social or ethnic division. And the three countries I worked in most recently, Liberia, Burundi, Nepal, were all dealing with post-conflict reconciliation, questions that went back a long way. And this is something the UN cannot engineer for other people. This has to be resolved domestically by people themselves. And of course, they can only do that if the leadership is inciting to unity rather than whipping up domestic division. And here, too, the Secretary General spoke of political figures who were stroking resentment for political gain. My fears actually go further, and we can maybe deepen this conversation later, and that is where we see, beyond that division, an attempt to sabotage national institutions, whether those are rule of law institutions or institutions that preserve public knowledge or institutions that hire people based on expertise rather than political agendas. All of these acts kind of close off citizens' sense of belonging and engagement. And so this is a really serious form of fragmentation that we should all feel challenged by, because this is all around us. Lastly, is the internal fragmentation that has always characterized the UN as an operational actor. And I think in terms of peace operations, which is where all three of us have come from, and by that I mean what are now 15 peacekeeping operations with military and about 15 non-military peace operations, political operations. For a long time, the UN has felt itself to be kind of at the edge of what we were able to do, really challenged to fulfill all these big mandates. But in each of these countries, the rest of the UN is active as well. The UN is working on health, on refugees, on children, on development. And within the UN, this hasn't always resolved itself into one shared conversation about how we are working towards particular political and development and human rights ends in the country. And surprisingly, because I don't want to end on too sad a note, this may be the challenge which is now easiest to resolve. It was so striking last October when the Security Council voted quickly to select this new Secretary General, which seemed to be a collective determination to have an effectively led UN. So my hope is that with the reform push we're seeing, putting more money into preventing conflict, stepping up mediation, reforming the different bits of the UN to work together, this may be heading in the right direction, if nothing else. Where the Women, Peace, and Security agenda fits into this, I sometimes think the biggest challenge it has is for people to understand what it is. And you know it's broadly three things. It's addressing sexual violence in conflict, it's having women represented effectively in peace operations and at the UN, and it's understanding and addressing the possibly differential impacts on men and on women of what takes place in a peace process. In my last posting in Liberia, we made a special effort to involve women in a constitutional reform process. We organized meetings all around the country. We saw women strongly represented at the first constitutional review meeting in 2015. So there have been improvements, but there are two things that are an enduring challenge, two enduring challenges. One is that we see a tendency to have one of these aspects of the WPS agenda kind of act as a proxy for the rest of the agenda. So women at the table, good, tick, that's done. We know, you know in this room, that that's not enough. The other challenge is that researchers have found that the more acute the crisis, the less attention the Security Council will give to the gender agenda. So in this moment of a number of particularly acute crises, I fear that the WPS agenda is really going to have to struggle for space.
Thank you. I think when I look at the challenges, one is striking to me is the sense that somehow the frameworks that we've been using over years to analyze, to rationalize, to propose solutions have kind of organized, have been organized through the norms and the standards of the humanitarian international law, the human rights law, and the refugee law. And if we go further, we will see the organization around the economic, the social, the culture, and also the religion. And somehow I feel that this is what is the challenge right now, because we are navigating enormous amount of unknowns. Unknowns because our paradigm has shifted. The known is now becoming the obsolete. It's now becoming like old thinking. And the youth, and I'm going to there, the youth are asking for something which is different from whatever was before. And we have not yet been able to articulate what this is, this void, this something. It's about the mind in the mind. It's about the connection to a reality of what I call the world in D, with the letter D, for those who are following. You are talking about distress. You are talking about discrimination. You are talking about despair. You are talking about degradation. You are talking about disempowerment. All of these D, and there are many of them, you are like, okay, so for the young people, for the children, for the generations that are coming up, what are we going to give as a legacy of what they can work with? And this is where, for me, being in this setting, and thank you for the invitation, is an opportunity to encourage each one of you not to feel this disempowerment, not to feel that you are powerless, but on the contrary, to say, because of all of these D, words starting with D, this is now where we need the energy, a positive energy to come and to challenge the old world and to be able to move into a world where you feel that it is meaningful and it has a purpose and is shying away from the use of violence and the resort to violence as a way to express anger and as a way to express frustrations, and as a way to ensure that what is inside is also what we see outside. And unfortunately, it's not just about the institutions, it's not just about the norms and the standards that we are sometimes imposing on others, it's not just about all of this, it's about the collectivity and the collective for the public good to agree on what are the elements we can all work on while opening our antennas and having the courage to stand for peace and not seeing peace as the absence of conflict, because it's not because there is no conflict and violent conflict in this place, for instance, that there is peace. Peace is something which is earned, is something we work towards, it is a goal, and for this we need both energy, the male energy and the female energy. We cannot achieve this where inside we are against the other. So the other has to become like us. When we are able to move from the I versus the us and the we, I believe that we can shift something in the new era of where we are going, where people are looking and young people are looking for purpose, for meaningful engagement. And I'm not talking about the empire of Facebook or the republic of Facebook. And I'm not talking about the empire of Twitters. I'm talking about the human-to-human connection and the willingness to look someone in the eyes and being able to recognize the other human being in the other.
Thanks very much. I just agree entirely with what Karen and Bintu have just said, but I just wanted to make two more points. And I think this time looking at the medium to longer term, I think we're at a critical moment now, because I think there are other forces which are bringing this confrontation, this spirit of confrontation to a head. One is population growth, and the other one is inevitably climate change as well. And I think with climate change, we're going to see the UN becoming more relevant in a sense, because how on earth do you get a global solution to that without the UN? But also more challenged as well, and particularly when it comes to conflict. Climate change, we could see already, was something of a factor in CAR in helping to drive the conflict there, because there were huge numbers of cattle coming down from Chad, from Sudan, from South Sudan into CAR in numbers that had just not been seen before. And that was exacerbating tensions in certain areas. And that's the kind of thing that, you know, a small thing like that can really make a difference to a conflict situation. And the second thing is, I think people are going to be more, big countries, which have hitherto maybe been donors, are going to be more and more focused on problems at home as climate change hits. And so resources for the UN, resources for finding international solutions to threats to global peace and security may be much more challenged. So I think that's going to be a challenge that the UN is also going to have to face.
I'd now like to move the conversation to prevention of conflict. As we know, the new Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, has made this one of his priorities of his tenure. But Bintu, can you actually tell us what does it mean, prevention of conflict on the ground, and how would you like the UN and its partners actually to go about preventing conflict? What should be done? And specifically, what's the role of women, or what could be the role of women as a factor to prevent conflict? Thank you.
Thank you. So the prevention as a vision expressed and clearly articulated by the Secretary General, I think this is available, and I encourage everyone to go and read it. But from the perspective of the field, I believe first is to agree that the Sustainable Development Goals is one of the agenda and the goals that have to be implemented as a way to harness the possibility for prevention of conflict or triggers of conflict when it is based on the absence of basic services, it is based on absence of jobs, it's based on absence of livelihoods, and any prospect of possibility to move freely from one place to the next. Just taking Darfur as an example. Darfur is as big as France, huge, and if we talk about the inhabitants, like a little more than 8 million. 8 million, you have 2.7 million of internally displaced people in Darfur. 2.7 million. Most of them being children and women. You have 1.6 million of internally displaced among this figure who are living in camps, what we call the IDP camp, or the gathering site when the governor, the government doesn't recognize the place, the location. So to take all of this and to see that actually all the indicators for Darfur are the same actually are the indicators in the Greater Sudan when it comes to the basic services and everything. But in the context of Darfur, it's even worse. So the response of the international community is on the humanitarian side and the relief of that. And this has been going on for more than 13 years now. And there is a fatigue around it. So when you tour all the five states of Darfur and you speak with the communities, you engage with them, you know what they say? We are on stage overall of a global environment which has decided that unless there is a comprehensive peace agreement, there will be no resources flowing in Darfur, and we also have the sanctions, and we also have a number of other elements, including from the justice side, which are really tremendous, putting tremendous distress on the situation in Darfur. We have armed movement who are living, leaders are living outside of Darfur for so many years. They still feel that they are connected to the population on the ground, but when we look at what this means, I would say, please, if there is one thing which can be done, don't agree, let's not agree to leave the population of Darfur hostage of a sequential, a sequenced approach to everything. So you have the humanitarian window for everything. Then you have the early recovery to recovery. This is another window. Then you have the development. This is another window. And then you have the what I will call the peace process. And in all of this, the people have to live every day. And they have to live every day with the dire situation that I have said. So if we want to make change in the prevention, and I see the link and the interlinkages between sustainable development goals and the peace and sustaining peace agenda, we have to make sure that resources are flowing to support the services that are required to lift up, at least not just put people in survival mode, but a little more than survival mode. This is one aspect. The other aspect for me is, in terms of the prevention, is to make sure that the diplomacy around peace process is including women. And for me, it's not just women at the VIP level of the peace talks. It has to be all the way down to the communities, because this is where the difference is made. And I will take one example in terms of when we managed to stamp out Ebola in West Africa. It's when we understood towards the very end that we had to engage the communities, and through the communities, we had to go with the women who were able to influence the other members of the community, so then we could move forward with another type of dialogue and another type of consultation and engagement, so we could pull back in the urge to do for them, but to let people have the ability to also show that even when they are poor, they still have capacities, skills, competencies, and they bring something at the table. So as you are student, one invite for you is, please, there is one quality in being humble to acknowledge the other, not as the object of receiver something, but as someone who is a partner to advance. And prevention for me, from that angle, is where we should be going, walking the talk of what actually the human rights-based approach to programming is saying. You have to engage. You have to make people participate. You have to consult. Don't, in your mind, feel that you are superior because you went to, I don't know, I don't want to offend anyone. Because the others, they will bring things that you don't know, you cannot touch, but still they are valuable in the process of making the change and the transformation. So for the prevention, this is how I want you to approach it. And then we need more women mediators. I take one example, and I've already said it, so no one is going to criticize me. If you take the peace talk in Sudan, and particularly in the context of Darfur, who is the head of mission, a man? Who is the special envoy, a man? Who is the United Nations, African Union interlocutor, a man? Who is the most of the special envoys, men? So, and this is not just the responsibility of the UN or the African Union, it's also the responsibility of the member states. Because the member states, when they have to decide who they are going to send, they will come and tell you that they looked around, they looked very, very hard, and they found no one but a man to do the job. So these things, so these are some of the bias that we have in the context of women, peace and security, really challenge and get the courage to say, and I say it to one of the Peace Building Commission visit delegation to Burundi, when I was in Burundi, they were coming and asking us to talk about the government of Burundi being gender sensitive and to walk the talk. And I said, okay, come on, guys. No qualification there. Where is the woman in this delegation? So when you left New York, have you thought about the fact that there is no woman in your delegation, yet you are asking the government of Burundi to make sure that women are at the table?
Yeah, Thank you, Bintu. You've raised many issues there. So maybe I can take a couple of them and throw them out to you, and maybe you could all have a go at responding to some of them. So you've spoken about peace processes and the role of how to really build in the community level contribution, participation in that. And that touches upon this so-called primacy of the political. So those of you who have already read the three reports that were done in 2015, which looked at the reform or questions surrounding the UN's peace and security work, there was a report on looking at the practice or non-practice of implementation of Security Council 1325 on women, peace and security. There was another report that looked at the peace-building architecture of the United Nations, and there was another report, which was a high-level report on peace operations. And they all started talking about this thing called the primacy of the political. So you've already started to tease this out, Bintu, but maybe Karen, you could tell us a little bit about how you've understood this primacy of the political and how you have actually sought to do something about that. And then I also want to flag this other issue of leadership, because you know, you're three women leaders here, so I would really like us to talk a little bit about your experiences of leadership. What does it mean in the UN? Is leading a UN entity different from leading some other kind of entity? And also, as women, do you bring anything different to it than male leaders, or is that a theory that we should debunk? So I just kind of throw those out. I have an eye on the clock, so we've got about 20 minutes left, but I just throw those out for you to kind of work off.
Can we stay until 8 o'clock in the morning? Because Bintu's given me about 16 things that I want to continue talking about. I will talk about the primacy of the political, but before that, I just want to say, and this is very much stimulated by what you say, when we go into working in peace operations, I find that the focus is so much on formal aspects of change. We tend to work on institutions and legislation. Those are areas we're very comfortable in. But somehow, as if by fixing an institution, human behavior will just fall in line and change. And yet we know that doesn't happen. Human behavior doesn't change unless you engage with people. And I defy you to show me a job description for a special representative of the Secretary General that talks about listening skills, or creativity, or curiosity. And really, those are the things we should be prioritizing and not falling into our grooved thinking about let's have a new constitution, elections, let's fix the rule of law. Those are all important. But if you haven't changed social norms and human behavior along the way, those are not going to represent lasting change. So the comprehensive approach, the listening aspect, I think we are still a long, long way behind. And this high-level independent panel on peace operations report from 2015 calls for a more people-centered approach on the part of the UN. But that will require an enormous cultural change at the highest levels of the UN. That's one reason I'm so enthusiastic about Bintu's appointment, because we're halfway there. So political approaches. It's one of the big recommendations of this HIPPO report. It's a very readable report. If you Google HIPPO report, it will actually come up. They had a sense of humor. But what the primacy of the political means is that we cannot fix these deep-rooted problems militarily. And there is no technical fix either. The Secretary General told the General Assembly, no one is winning today's wars. Absolutely, absolutely true. So political approaches mean understanding competing claims, where they stem from, what is legitimate, what is human rights compatible, and what a lasting settlement might look like. And this is where I think the curiosity and the creativity and the listening come in. There is no template for what the final settlement will look like. So broaching that discussion, talking up the possibilities, always being available, always listening, not representing any other interests, any hidden interests as the interlocutor, ideally helping the parties towards resolution before things spill over. Because once conflict breaks out, you've already lost a lot. And the conflict will quickly produce more grievances, more reasons not to talk, and it gets harder to row things back from there. In my three postings, seven of the last 9 years, I've worked in the aftermath of conflict, so there has been a peace agreement. But as you know, a peace agreement is always a compromise, and people aren't, when they settle, they aren't in a hurry to give up at the negotiating table the things they didn't win on the battlefield. So you've got a lot of language in there about what has to happen, but often deep disagreements about how to make them happen. And the UN's aim is to favor inclusive politics. So when I tried to apply this in Burundi, we weren't there at the same time, Burundi had quite a remarkable peace agreement, the Arusha Peace and Reconciliation Agreement, in 2000. And not all the warring parties joined at once, some joined later. But a remarkable aspect of it was that it spelled out remedies for ethnic division. It set quotas for the army, for example, 50% Tutsi, 50% Hutu, and that had been a Tutsi-dominated institution. And I talked to many Burundians who were very proud of this peace agreement, who said that the way of approaching this was to talk about it, in contrast to Rwanda, which chose a different path. They were proud of their army integration. But after quite a successful election in 2005, there was deterioration. And in 2010, and I came in the wake of the 2010 election, there was considerable violence, and about a dozen parties withdrew after the first round of voting. There were some actors returning to paramilitary activities, encouraging armed rebellion, members of these parties being killed, tortured, disappeared, and harassed by government agents, pressure on civil society, pressure on the media, and meanwhile a parliament that was itself less diverse and less representative. So that was a backward step. However, the president had pledged at his swearing in to provide political space to all parties, and he called on the political leaders who had fled to return. So even that, if that was at odds with what we were seeing, we took that pledge as a starting point and set about trying to talk to everyone to create conditions under which the extra parliamentary parties, as we call them, would be able to return in safety and would have something to talk about with the government. And this meant taking a clear and consistent and positive line around a vision for Burundi getting back to everyone coexisting in a multi-party democracy. There were some successes in 2012, in particular with the return of a number of political leaders in safety for discussions about issues of common concern. So we also tried to create common ground. An important point here is that success doesn't have to have your fingerprints on it. So we were encouraging other bilaterals, international NGOs, organizations, everybody, to do what they could as well. This didn't have to be a UN-owned, positive development. But, and I left Burundi in 2012, and what we're seeing today is that the Arusha Agreement has all but broken down. Hundreds of thousands of people have fled. Critical national institutions are under attack. President Nkurunziza stood for, since I don't speak for the UN, I would say a probably unlawful third term. The former head of security, a former head of the army have been assassinated. Several leading human rights actors have been killed or have been the victims of assassination attempts. And I think the glimmer of hope is that ordinary Burundians have resisted returning to war. They don't want to go back to war. So they haven't been goaded by everything around them to attacking their friends and neighbors. So this sort of conscious effort to create political space, as we see in so many other examples, the Northern Irish talks, you know, you have hundreds of failed attempts and then one that sticks. So again, just not giving up, I think, is a pretty important characteristic if you are going to lead these efforts, not getting discouraged. Keep on keeping on, and one of them will succeed.
Building on that, Diane, in Central African Republic, how did the mission, how did you all reach out to women to include them in the processes that were underway at the community level, at the central level?
Well, we had, when the mission started in 2014, we had a transitional government in place. It was kind of not quite self-appointed, but more or less. Likewise with the National Assembly as well, the transitional National Council. And so they were institutions which were open to challenge over their legitimacy. And so it was seen as important to get elections underway, to get a constitutional reform underway. I mean, some of the things that we've been talking about and criticizing and sort of, you know, because they're not just the only solution, but they're part of the solution. There were various elements that were sort of put in the roadmap for getting to those elections. And one of them was an idea which had actually the Central Africans themselves had developed, which was to have popular consultations about what kind of a country they wanted. And then there were all sorts of challenges. There was a big outbreak of violence in Bangui in October 2014. There was sort of, you know, people were saying, no, we've just got to go straight to elections. We've got to go as quickly as possible. But Central Africans pushed back, civil society, religious leaders, political leaders, and said, no, we must have these. They're really important. And it was such a good call. Throughout those, and again, I think, you know, this was partly an element that the UN was able to insert, because we were able to, when we were sort of developing the model for how they might work, because it was entirely dependent on our platform, basically, to get people around the country and to ensure that, they could actually take place at all in relative security, which they did amazingly. We were able to say things like, you know, you really do need to include women. And in fact, one thing I specifically said was, you need a quota, you need a minimum quota, you know, minimum 30% women. So, and that became a mantra. And it became, you know, out of the 10 women, the 10 people in each of the mediation teams went around the country, at least 3 were women. They were meant to talk to at least 30% women when they went out to the field. Didn't always work, but at least it was kind of accepted as a norm. And then we went on to the Bangui Forum, which was a big national forum, to sort of, again, discuss how to go forward on this. Again, the 30% women mantra kind of stuck. So I think it's just putting those, something like that, on the table. And again, this point about, you know, sometimes it's only when you have women there who think about these things. I went to so many meetings where I was the only woman, because there were, you know, political politicians. They were all, well, not all men, but, you know, a lot of them were men. The other leaders of the UN mission, the other lead ambassadors, everybody, they were all men. Sometimes you just have to speak up, and you kind of, I could almost feel myself being dismissed as sort of, oh yes, she's on her little feminist rant again. but actually, it somehow was also not seen as particularly threatening to suggest that we should have this quota, and it was a real enabler, and it did make a big difference. It meant that when people were talking about what they wanted, yes, they said they wanted security, but they also wanted justice. And a lot of victims spoke up during the consultations and also in the Bangui Forum themselves. Bangui Forum could very easily have been dominated by discussions with the armed groups because they were represented there, but it wasn't. And there were lots of other issues that were discussed and debated there. And I think that the presence of A certain number of women, I suspect it probably got squeezed down to 25% rather than 30%, did actually make a real difference. So I would say that. Unfortunately, when the elections actually took place, women didn't do particularly well. There's only about, I think it's 11 out of 140 MPs who are women. So more work needs to be done. But it really does make a difference. It just meant that there was a different agenda on the table, and there were different aspects of the peace process that were being discussed. We got a much better set of conclusions out of the Bangui Forum, which kind of was adopted by everybody and is still now seen as a basic text, the Republican Pact, which everybody wants to abide by. So I think it really did make a difference.
Congratulations. Listening to you, I don't know you guys in the audience how you're going to react to my next comment, but listening to you, listening to how you speak, listening to your experience, I think there are a number of commonalities that come out about you, actually. You've all spoken about the need to be humble, to work behind the scenes, not to always take the glory. You've talked a lot about listening. I think, unintentionally or not, you've all shown great courage in what you do. It's not easy to go to a meeting and be the only man, the only woman, time and time and time again. It's not easy to put up with this feminist, you know, rant stuff. The ideas you've come up with, together obviously with your teams, they are courageous. Going to the countries you go to, where you work in, that takes courage, great courage. You've also, I think, in your work, demonstrated a lot of vision. You've also highlighted the need for the country to develop its vision, and you've highlighted the role of the UN as supporting that vision, not giving that vision to the people. And that takes great creativity and great innovation and great persistence. I have a sense that none of you give up easily. You've also alluded to the need to have the principles. You've talked about justice, you've talked about law, but I also have the sense that you're also quite pragmatic. And I would imagine that's within a certain boundary. So that wasn't necessarily what I thought I was going to hear from you, but I am thrilled that that's what's come across. I'm curious if that's what's come across to you, the audience. Do you see a lot of that in the other UN leaders, those qualities? Do you think those qualities are the key qualities? What else have we missed out? And also, I'm really curious on this question about being a woman leader. Do you bring some things that are different from men, or do you emphasize certain aspects that men don't? Just curious. We've got about 10 minutes or so for this question. Who'd like to go first?
So there's one quality, I think, that needs also to be added to that list and brought out more strongly, and that is to do with ethics and integrity. I think nothing tarnishes the UN faster or worse than examples of, whether it's sexual exploitation abuse or financial mismanagement, fraud, you know, people behaving badly. Other people hear that, see that, and they take away an impression of the whole UN as being that thing. So what I would certainly like to see the Secretary General do is revive the idea of this is an international civil service, and there are civil service, civil servant standards that we all need to uphold and meet. And integrity has to be a very big part of that. I think some people have been given a free pass. Some member states have shamefully defended people who should not have had a free pass. And I would like to see that element strengthened. Because in the end, what do we have? I think what you've heard is one of the strengths of the UN is we can convene anyone we like. We can bring women to the table. We can bring warring factions to the table. And we come, you know, with clean hands to that discussion. But to strengthen that, we have to be absolutely free of any shadow of ethical failure or lack of integrity.
Yes. I think that's absolutely right. I do think there are, you know, the UN is the guardian of so many international treaties and, you know, ideals, if you like, global ideals. And it must live up to those standards itself. It's absolutely critical that it should do so. And it's fundamentally damaging to the mission, to the organisation, if it doesn't. And that's why the whole question of sexual exploitation and abuse is so damaging to the work of the UN. And you absolutely have to have total zero tolerance for that. There's no excuse whatsoever. I think in terms of leadership, you asked the question about what qualities do women leaders bring. It's a bit difficult to say. You know, one doesn't like to sort of generalize in some ways. But we did have two of us who kind of came through the sort of external women's talent pipeline in MINUSCA. And I think there were a couple of things that I did notice that maybe we brought that contrasted a bit with some of our male colleagues, although, you know, they are... I don't want this to be a man-bashing session, because male leaders can actually be extraordinarily good as well. But I would say I thought that women often, you know, around the table, if you were having a discussion and you were in a crisis situation, women would often be calmer. And they might also be more solution-focused and actually bring the discussion back to, okay, so what are we going to do now? What are we going to do tonight? What are we going to do tomorrow? What instructions do we give to our military? What instructions do we give to our police? What do we do in the human rights front, et cetera, et cetera? So it's very task-focused, I think. I think also there's maybe a more inclusive leadership, because I think as a woman you naturally do try to ensure that other women are included in the discussion. And also I think there's more, and maybe it's because we come in as outsiders, I think there's more of allowing a culture of challenge and allowing your team to challenge you. I mean, obviously, you know, you are the leader, you're ultimately the one who takes the decision. You have to take responsibility, you have to take your responsibility seriously, but I do think you should be open to challenge as well, and people sort of should be feel free to speak up and offer their own ideas and express differences if they've got them. But ultimately, you know, they've got to accept that you're the one who takes the leader, has to take the decision. So I would say just those are some of the things that I would say I think women bring. Just one more thing. I do think women break the mold, and it changes the dynamic in those discussions with external, armed group leaders, politicians, whoever you're dealing with, because I think you sometimes find that people behave in a slightly more, I don't know, respectful way, maybe more civilized way somehow, and so that can be a positive.
I will take one example. We have overnight 20,000 people who fled fighting in the Jebel Mara in Darfur. They came to a tiny place, which was like a no man's land, but closer to a team site of UNAMID, where we had 275 peacekeepers. And I went there immediately after they have arrived, and I went with a delegation of men and women from different components from the mission. And while I was going through to meet actually the people who had fled and trying to understand the situation, what they had encountered while they were fleeing, etc., we came to several places where I found that it was awkward that I will ask the male colleagues to come with me into the makeshift shelter where the women were, and most of them had delivered babies during the while they were fleeing, and so very little. And as soon as they will see men, they will do like this. And I said, okay, so Bintu, this is now the time where you came with a team, inclusive team, but now you have to make clear that it's not because male colleagues cannot do that, but to access and to have the conversation with the woman, they need a private space, and they only are going to be comfortable if you are alone with them. And mind you, what happened? When I found myself in the room, I said, oh, I don't speak the language. So I had to quickly say, because I had a male translator, so I had to find a woman translator to be able to stand with the woman and understand what was going on. So this is something now, when I move around in Darfur, the delegations that are coming with me, the male colleague are saying, okay, just be ready, at some point she's going to kick you out. But not in a bad sense, just in the sense that men will feel more comfortable to talk about their stuff with men. It's shifting in the domain of the health. You have male and female doctors, and it's okay. But it's not in every place where we are at that level, where the level of comfort is with every gender the same way.
I still have so many questions I want to ask, including, you know, the nature of member state responsibility for the success or failure of peace operations, but I'm not going to ask. I'm actually going to now open it up to the floor. We do have stewards with the microphone, so please, if you could just put your hand up, and we'll take, as normal, three or four questions, and let's just move on. If we can start over there, the lady in the black.
Hi, thank you all for being here. My name is Caroline Wagner, and I'm an MSc in International Relations. And this past summer, I had experience working at the Joan Kroc Institute for Peace and Justice in their Women Peacemakers program, and also at a consulting firm called Institute for Development Impact, where we looked at how to solve sustainability challenges around the world at the community level. And so with those experiences together, I really saw how it is important to drive people up and create positive growth at the individual as well as the community, an informal system, formal system level, at all of those levels holistically. However, it's very challenging, and every place is different. And there's a conversation going on right now with like USAID, with the UN, with various consulting agencies around the world in the private sector about how to get the SDGs on the ground and how to work together to get these people better across the board. So I guess this question is specifically for Ms. Kita. You spoke a little bit about how important the SDGs are. How do you see us sort of working together with public-private partnerships in every different context around the world to kind of first measure what the issues are and then how to create sustainable solutions to those so that we can drive toward peace and prosperity for these people?
Thank you. There's a person in the back over there. Also, if I could just ask, just because I've seen already there are so many questions, if we could have really either no context or very limited and just go straight to the question, only because there's so many questions and these guys up here on the panel have so much to share. Thank you.
Hi, thank you again for being here. So my question is a bit similar, going off the point of incorporating SDGs as conflict prevention measures. I was wondering how, if at all, would they be incorporated into peace building measures that the UN might have changed since they were passed in the past few years?
Thank you all for your talks. My question pertains to, I think, an important point that was brought out, and it was incorporating the voices of everyone, even within women. So my question is, I was in Geneva, and again, you see certain backgrounds of people in a lot of these institutions. So what is actually happening to promote women, not necessarily from a certain fragment of society coming through, but the voices of people you would normally expect? How is the UN actually promoting those voices? Because from what I saw, that penetration isn't really happening. And what can you do more to encourage that?
Hi, Hi, good evening. My name is Joseph Akibinza, and I'm from the MSc Human Rights Program. I wanted, first of all, to thank you again for your presence tonight. And coming back from what Mrs. Landgren said at the beginning of the talk, mentioning that she wanted to encourage us to start a career in peace operations, I wanted to ask all of you, like, how do we still manage to prevent conflict with so much less resources? Because, you know, like Mr. Guterres is advocating for the prevention of conflict, but he's also been running on the grounds of stopping sending peacekeepers to places where there's no peace to keep. So I was wondering, how can peace operation still manage to deliver in this specific context?
I don't know whether you'd like all to start going through them, or maybe Bintu to begin with the SDG question that was specifically addressed to you.
So the implementation of the SDGs in a context of partnership, because there is no way out of the partnership approach to implementation. I believe one of the elements to first acknowledge is that it's through partnership and no other way around. Second is to also agree that not all the 17 SDGs will be relevant to the immediacy of what people are encountering where they are. So it means in some places, because this is universal, so in some places you will have the 17, which are all interconnected, that will be relevant, and in some other places, and taking again the Darfur context, they will say, Madam, what we want water, we want education, we want school, actually, this is how they say it. We want schools, we want both primary schools, and we want secondary schools. These are the two things that they will tell you. Then they will say, we also want health clinics. And when they say health clinics, they mean the primary health care, because of all the indicators that we know, all of us we know. So, and I'm sure if I find myself in another place, in a more sophisticated place, they will talk about the water, life underwater, this kind of stuff, which is relevant, is important, but in the context of Darfur, it's absolutely not. So then in the context of the partnership with the private sector, there is all the element around corporate social responsibility, which I think it's a time to kind of rekindle that aspect of the work with the private sector, that they also have a moral responsibility with all the people that they are employing and the people that they are going to employ, and also that their survival is also linked to the survival of those who are around them. So this is one thing. One piece which is missing in my view is how do we deal with the number 16 of the SDG, with peace and security, particularly around the challenges on religion, culture, because there what I'm missing personally is the voices of the religious leaders, all religion, to stand up for peace. So that partnership, I think, is still something which is in the making. I don't see it at the scale where it is required right now.
Let me try to tie those questions together and say that our job is always to work out where the fault lines are in a society, where the emerging problems are going to be. And civil wars, what happened last time may or may not be relevant. Civil wars start being about one thing and then they change shape and become about something else. And increasingly, it is this idea that you have to have a comprehensive approach. The war may start over resources. It may start over access. Those different windows are, for people living them, they are one window of problems. But at the same time, what we're seeing is fewer and fewer practitioners working at community level. There's such a convergence in the capitals of countries. That's where the visibility is. That's where the UN goes, NGOs go. MSF had a publication a few years ago called Where Is Everybody? And it reflected this. Well, we're all sitting in the same donor meetings in the capital, which is not where the problem is. So really, the people I want to recruit are the people who have community-based experience more than necessarily diplomatic experience. If you've been an organizer, if you've been involved in Ebola response at community level, local dispute resolution, setting up anything sustainable that helps communities work together in an integrated way, I think that is the most valuable asset for the UN to try to harness right now, provided the UN also makes a big effort to be present outside the capital.
There was a question about how do we incorporate the voices of everyone in police peace processes. I think it's a challenge, and I think it's something that we constantly need to challenge ourselves about. It's too easy to have a peace process which consists of government representatives and armed groups, and that's about it, and maybe a couple of representatives of political parties or civil society, and you might just about get one woman around the table in that context. But I think, you know, what we did with the popular consultations in the Central African Republic was so important in terms of ensuring that, and then in the Bangui Forum as well, ensuring that it was very clear to everybody that the armed groups are a tiny minority of the population. The vast majority of the population is controlled, is manipulated by them, is in many cases held hostage by them, but they don't actually represent much other than themselves. And I think that that's something that we've constantly got to be aware of. So constantly think of ways of creatively including the population. And I just mentioned that the parliament at the moment is not very inclusive in terms of gender. So how do you tap into the voices of women? How do you tap into the voices of people who are out in the regions a very long way from Bangui? That's something that you've constantly got to look at. So it could be, you know, ensuring that the president can get around and that he can have these dialogues with his population. Likewise with other ministers, ensuring that MPs can get back to their constituencies so they know what's happening on the ground. We were also looking at having a rerun of something like the popular consultations, but that's very, very challenging in the current security situation. I think also just, you know, talking about starting a career in peace operations and how to prevent conflict with less resources, and how do we stop peace where there is no peace to keep. I mean, you know, the fact is the UN is trying to stop peace where there is no peace to keep. I mean, it is trying to stop wars from re-erupting. We've got, you know, Darfur, we've got Central African Republic. And the UN, you might think, you know, on the one hand, the UN may be accused of failing because it's not stopping those wars. But believe me, if the UN wasn't there, the situation would be so much worse. The success of many UN missions is what they prevent. And that is very hard to quantify, but believe me, when you're there on the ground, you can see it. I do think that the UN is going to remain open to tackling very difficult situations, very complex and occasionally violent situations, but it's not always possible. Of course, it depends a little bit on what is going on in the Security Council, as we know. Yeah.
Thank you. If I can turn now to this corner. We have this person sitting in the front.
Hi, so nice to meet all of you. My question is, how damaging do you think it is when you have incidents of sexual abuse committed by UN soldiers? And in my case, I work in Haiti. And on top of that, you have Nepalese UN soldiers, apparently, introducing cholera to the country. So how damaging would that be for the UN as an institution, and what do you do to try to, you know, prevent those things?
Thank you. And this person in the black.
Thanks. Hello, I'm Corinne Kitzel. I'm the from the Foreign Office, where I'm the head of the conflict department and the Foreign Office's UN coordinator. I just wanted to make one comment and then ask a question. The comment follows on from the point about UN member states and how we promote our nationals into jobs in the UN. And the UN Secretary General ran something earlier this year called the Global Core. Well, he asked member states to nominate up to 4 people for senior leadership roles in the UN, and he said 2 of those 4 had to be female. The UK made a decision to ensure that all 4 of our nominees for senior leadership positions were women, so that was one thing that we did that was positive. My question is around the whole sustaining peace agenda, and of course, because of the backgrounds of our 3 speakers, this conversation is focused very much on peacekeeping operations and special political missions. And we've heard about the peacekeeping, the high-level panel on peace operations report and the peace-building architecture review. But what would be your tips for how we can promote a more joined-up approach to sustaining peace across the whole agenda? I mean, even the UN Secretary General talks in terms of peace and security reform and development and humanitarian reform. So how can we join that up? Thanks.
Thank you. And if a person just...
Hi, so my question's on responsibility to protect. I know we've been talking a lot about how military intervention is seen as kind of an arm of RTP, but I think a lot of us forget almost that capacity building and conflict prevention is also tied up in that. And so looking at member state responsibility, how would, whether it be RTP or another policy or rule of law, what would motivate member states to take that responsibility in a form of collective action?
Thank you. That's great. Who would like to begin with the sexual exploitation and abuse response? Mm-hmm.
I think I can speak for all of us and say these are the things that keep us up at night. When you are so badly failing to protect the people you're there to protect, that you are injuring them instead. And it is adding insult to injury if we can't, when that happens, address it frankly as the UN. The good news is that we see some changes. We see readiness to be more critical of the countries, name and shame the countries that have a bad record in this regard, to send entire units home, to have a more aggressive policy on responding to sexual exploitation and abuse. And this Secretary General has put forward a new policy. So for countries that are repeatedly sending abusive troops, who also see great benefit in being part of UN peacekeeping, to say that this isn't going to happen, this is a black mark against the country. And no country is immune to sending abusers. So I think this is what academics call unintended externalities of peace operations, but I do see a greater willingness to address those. There were years when we could not discuss the Haiti cholera epidemic internally, and I despaired at that. To take one other question, I think this was the question from the Foreign Office. What we are seeing is, with a reform shakeup, some of the internal UN structures around who does what. I think by year's end we're going to see other changes there that should lead to perhaps less jealous ownership and guardianship of the particular windows that Bintu referred to, and even the particular staff positions. To have, starting at working level, at country level and at working level in headquarters, one country conversation, so that we're not having this fragmented discussion. Some resident coordinators in the field, countries that don't have a special representative, have said it's all very well the Secretary General telling us to be courageous and brave, but if we're getting 6 different instructions from different parts of headquarters, what are we supposed to follow? So it's also about having one approach, one conversation about an approach to follow per country that should lead us to be more coherent and more effective, less compartmentalized.
Thank you. Bintu?
Just wanted to respond on the global call. I'm happy that to hear that UK did very well. But just to give the overall, there was 765 nominations from 126 countries. And the number of women, despite the elements that were given, is at 41%. And nearly half of the 41 member states had submitted nominations. And normally more men than women, and of the 75%, 75% submitted only male nominations. So this is a challenge. I'm not saying that it's 41% is better than what we had years ago, but it's still not where we should be. On the SEA, I think Karin has responded. It's really a vicious scourge, and I also agree with Karin that the new Secretary General has really taken special measures and boldened even the conversation, because not as far as the beginning of this week, there was a high-level panel on this same conversation. And it's also about the circle of leadership around it. And he has also proposed a compact between member states and the UN. So there are a number of measures that have been put forward, including two high-level women dealing with the issue, Jane Hall Lute from the U.S., and Jane Connors from Australia. And these two will have to drive the response. And I also want to say that when you look at the overall number, we are talking about more than 110,000 peacekeepers. And I would really hate to say that for few, which is absolutely disgusting, every single one of the peacekeepers is looked through the lenses of being an abuser. This is not the reality. And I think we have to acknowledge that. It's damaging, it's for our reputation, it's awful. And at the same time, you have good work which is done, and some of them were illustrated by what Diane was saying, and I think we have to put all of this into perspective. So, yes, let's not throw everybody through the drain because of some who are not living up to the task and the behavior which is expected, and as Karin said, ethics, integrity, and accountability to the affected population that we are serving, it's not negotiable.
Can I just add, please, a couple more points? I mean, I think, as Bintu and Karin has said, I think that the UN's approach has really been transformed over the last few years, and I think that there's the big change is that it's gone from reactive to proactive, and now there is an assumption, or I sense that there's an assumption, that if you don't do something to prevent SEA, it will happen, and that is the right approach. You've got to assume that it will happen unless you actively try to combat it. You know, it is enormously challenging. You've got a very large number of troops. You've got, troops in very remote locations, and troops are changing every year as well. So there's a new cycle. So it's a constant work, and you have constantly got to get that message across that there is zero tolerance. You can't stop. The other thing I would say, I think one of the things which has really come out, even in say CAR, is that no matter where you are, it will get out. Even in very remote places in CAR, we found out about cases, and we got the information.
And so you can't hide this kind of stuff anymore. And that's a very strong message that I think needs to be put across as well. But there is further work to do. I think that keeping up the momentum on this is really important for the UN. It's not a problem that the UN can ever feel that it's solved. It's got to keep working at prevention and making sure that it doesn't recur. I personally think that more women in leadership will help that, we're gradually seeing that. But I think another very big element of this is convicting the perpetrators of sexual exploitation and abuse. There are far too few convictions. If you look at the number of cases, and the figures are all out there on the website, and you look at the number of people who've actually been convicted of crimes, it's very, very small. It's very depressing when you see that. Much more work needs to be done with troop contributing countries, with member states. They're the ones generally who have the responsibility for ensuring that their troops behave. They're the ones who have control over the military code, the military legal process, and they've got to be held up to account for that and for those figures.
Thank you so much. It's 8 o'clock, so I'm going to have to wrap this up. I would very much want to thank the Centre for Women, Peace and Security for organising this event, noting particularly that we are celebrating it on International Day of Peace. I particularly want to thank Zoe Gilliard, who does so much for all of us all the time, and your team for bringing this together. I also want to thank you for coming along, particularly the students. I understand this is your first week in, but you haven't had classes yet, so thank you for coming. I suspect this has inspired you or some of you, and I think it would be really fab if some at least of you could follow up on Karen's opening call to you to join the United Nations and serve the cause of peace. I'm happy to tell you that Jane Connors, who Bintu mentioned, Jane Connors is the victim's advocate. So that's the victims' advocate, victims of sexual exploitation and abuse, whom the Secretary General appointed a few weeks ago. Jane Connors will be at an event run by the Centre on the 7th of November, and that's on a subject that's kind of come up in this meeting on gender equality and the UN. Jane is a tough cookie. She's very direct and she makes things happen. So I would really encourage all of you to come and listen to that event, where there'll be a number of other very highly experienced speakers. Last of all, would like on behalf of everybody to thank the panelists. I served in the United Nations for 15 years and in a number of peace operations. And the thing that was the most important for me, and the thing that I think makes a difference on the UN's ability to serve the people it was mandated to serve and protect, is the quality of the leadership. I was very privileged to serve with the leaders I did, and I would love to serve or have served with any one of you. I think you're amazing. I think your sacrifice, your personal sacrifice over the years, is amazing. I really thank you on behalf of the colleagues here today and all other UN staff members. It's people like you that helps us believe that that organization can and will live up to those amazing ideals that it was set up for. So I thank you so much.